Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. If you're tuning in right now, Democracy Now! Is probably your source for news you can trust. I'm asking for your support because, unlike the cable news shows or commercial media, our news hour is not funded by the oil, gas, coal, or nuclear companies when we cover climate change, or by the weapons manufacturers when we cover war and peace. It's funded by people like you and not like you, who share the value of free speech, deeply believe in independent media. That's what keeps Democracy Now! Independent. If you and everyone like you who tunes into this podcast made just one $10 donation right now, we could cover our operating costs for 2018. Really, that's all it would take. If you think like I do that the media can be the greatest force for peace on earth, make your tax-deductible donation today by visiting us at democracynow.org. Have a wonderful holiday season, Happy New Year, and thank you so much. From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Roughly 6 million Americans are affected by bipolar disorder, but there's, you know, more than 40 million people any given year are experiencing mental illness. And so bipolar disorder is a part of kind of a much larger conversation. One of the reasons I wrote it as a memoir is that I think that people really related to some of the symptoms, the way my family had to deal with it, the way I dealt with it, which was not always good.
Jamie Lowe on her memoir, Mental, Lithium, Love, and Losing My Mind. She'll take us on a journey from an adolescent psych ward in Los Angeles to the salt flats of Bolivia, where half the world's lithium deposits are found. But first, bust out. Ticket to where?
It's like, close the door, get out of here, we bought you a bus ticket, you can't come back. That put a hurting on me. I feel like I was swindled. They tell you anything because they want you out of here. They want all the homeless out of Key West.
As temperatures plunge across the United States and the homeless population is rising for the first time since the Great Recession, more cities are giving thousands of homeless people one-way tickets to leave town. We'll speak with The Guardian's homelessness editor, who oversaw an 18-month investigation that reveals many people who are bussed out become homeless again and return to the city they left. By the way, it's negative 37 degrees Fahrenheit in Minnesota, smashing a record from almost 100 years ago. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Afghanistan, at least 40 people have been killed and dozens more wounded in a suicide bomb attack in the capital, Kabul. ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attack, which targeted a Shia cultural center and the Afghan Voice News Agency. The Afghan Journalist Safety Committee says at least one journalist was killed in the attack and another four were wounded. The blast struck as students were attending a discussion forum at the cultural center, marking the 38th anniversary of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. This is an eyewitness to the attack, Ali Reza.
I saw many dead in the area. I was looking for my cousin, but I could not find his body. I'm not sure what happened to him. The number of dead people has increased.
This comes only days after ISIS claimed responsibility for another suicide bombing in Kabul, which killed 10 people. President Trump has lied about signing more pieces of legislation than any president in U.S. history, when in fact he signed fewer pieces of legislation so far than any president since Dwight Eisenhower, who took office in 1953. This is Trump speaking to firefighters in West Palm Beach, Florida, Wednesday.
More legislation passed, including the record was Harry Truman. A long time ago, and we broke that record, so we have a lot done.
That's President Trump falsely claiming he's broken previous presidents' legislative records. In fact, so far, he signed the fewest bills into law in more than 60 years. Republican Roy Moore has filed a lawsuit seeking to stop the state of Alabama from certifying his rival, Democrat Doug Jones, as the winner of the special U.S. Senate race 2 weeks ago in Alabama. Moore lost the highly controversial race to Jones by about 20,000 votes after at least 9 women accused Moore of harassing or sexually assaulting them when they were teenagers, one as young as 14 years old. African-American voters were critical in defeating Moore, who has a long history of racism, sexism, homophobia and Islamophobia. On Wednesday, Moore's lawyers filed the lawsuit claiming fraud and demanding a new election. The state canvassing board had been slated to officially declare Jones the winner at its meeting today. The Trump administration's rollback regulations at nursing homes nationwide, meaning nursing homes that injure residents or place them at grave risk, will face fewer and less costly fines. The nursing home industry lobbied for the deregulation. Advocates for nursing home residents say the deregulation threatens to roll back years of hard-fought progress in improving care and deterring neglect and mistreatment of elderly residents. In Honduras, the opposition party, the Alliance Against the Dictatorship, has filed an appeal with election officials demanding incumbent President Juan Orlando Hernandez's reelection be annulled because of fraud in the November 26 election. The Organization of American States has also called for a reelection amidst reports of widespread fraud and vote rigging. But the United States, which backs Hernandez, has endorsed his reelection. The contested vote sparked weeks of protests in which at least 22 people have been killed in the ensuing military crackdown against protesters. To see our interview with journalist Alan Nairn just back from Honduras, go to democracynow.org. In West Africa, Liberia is slated to announce the results today of the runoff presidential election between Vice President Joseph Boakye and the ex-footballer George Weah, Liberia's current president. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was the first woman elected head of state of Africa. She's been president since 2006. This year's election will mark the first peaceful transfer of power in Liberia since 1944. In Bolivia, protests by health workers are escalating amidst a month-long strike in the capital, La Paz. The strike and protests are part of a rising wave of dissent in Bolivia over President Evo Morales' controversial decision to seek a fourth term in 2019, despite the Bolivian constitution permitting presidents to serve only 2 consecutive terms. This is protester Julia Maceda Aliaga.
It's a dictatorship. Not in the worst moments of the dictatorial governments has this occurred. I say to the gentleman, Evo, if he is a gentleman, Evo, don't provoke us. The people are angry.
In France, hundreds of residents of a small French Alpine town marched silently in the pouring rain Wednesday to demand answers in the case of the disappearance of a 9-year-old girl, Mélise de Araujo, when missing while attending a family wedding in late August. A fellow guest at the wedding, a 34-year-old former military dog trainer, is being investigated for kidnapping and murder. The girl's DNA was found in the man's car, but he denies involvement in the crime. This is Nadine, one of the hundreds who marched on Wednesday.
Moi aussi, j'ai 3 enfants, 2 petits enfants, et donc c'est vrai que ça.
I also have 3 children and 2 grandchildren, so it's true that it's quite earth-shattering. In a small village like this, we think it will never happen to us, but it does, actually. It happens everywhere, unfortunately. It's not easy. It's especially hard for the parents, so I think if people come to support them, it's always a help for the family.
In Burma, authorities have extended the detention of a pair of Reuters journalists who could face up to 14 years in prison for allegedly violating Burma's Official Secrets Act. Walon and Kiasoo had been reporting on military-backed violence against minority Rohingya Muslims in Rakhine State before their arrest on December 12th. Reuters editor-in-chief called the arrests a blatant attack on press freedom, and their arrests have sparked an international outcry. Back in the United States and Texas, the immigration lawyer for detained Mexican journalist Emilio Gutierrez Soto says the Board of Immigration Appeals has reopened Gutierrez's asylum case and vacated his deportation order for now. This means Gutierrez cannot be deported at the moment and that the Board of Immigration Appeals will now issue a new ruling over whether to grant the journalist asylum. Gutierrez first sought asylum in the United States in 2008 after receiving death threats for reporting on alleged corruption in the Mexican military. He and his son are currently imprisoned in a U.S. detention center in El Paso, Texas. This is Gutierrez speaking in an exclusive jailhouse interview with Democracy Now!
Well, if we are deported, that obviously implies death. Why? Because ICE, under the Department of Homeland Security of the United States, by law, must give a report to the immigration authorities of Mexico and the consulate. And the immigration officials in Mexico have no credibility. It's impossible to trust in them. To the contrary, many of those officials, many personnel at the consulate or immigration service are caught up with organized crime. And organized crime is precisely the Mexican government.
That's Mexican journalist Emilio Gutierrez Soto speaking by telephone from jail in Texas. His lawyer and press freedom advocates are demanding his and his son's immediate release. To see our full exclusive jailhouse interview with Emilio Gutierrez, go to democracynow.org. A record-smashing cold spell continues to freeze parts of the Northeast and Midwest United States. In Minnesota, the temperature plunged to 37 degrees below zero in International Falls, breaking the previous record set almost 100 years ago in 1924. Wind chill advisories have been issued for swaths of the country, with forecasters warning of hypothermia and frostbite from Arctic air. And pioneering Argentinian filmmaker Fernando Birri has died. He's considered the father of the new Latin American cinema, which challenged Hollywood and focused on the lives of the oppressed in Latin America. Along with Gabriel Garcia Marquez and others, Birri founded the International School of Film and Television in Cuba and served as the school's first director. This is the Argentine filmmaker reading a poem in a short film by Michael Chanon entitled Portrait of Fernando Birri.
Poem in the form of a film poster. I see a green parrot in the zoo in Berlin. And I think, the new Latin American cinema is today a reality. But 25 years ago, it was a utopia. Which is the new utopia? And the parrot, the green parrot, whose name in Latin is very difficult, but who is surely called Juancito or Nemesio, is a parrot from the Alto Paraná. That's to say, my brother or my cousin. I saw him. And I think national identity. Did the parrot need its national and critical identity? But us, we do. We needed it. For a national cinema, realist and critical. Later, we added popular.
Argentine filmmaker Fernando Birri has died at the age of 92 in Rome. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. As much of the Midwest faces winter snowstorms and the East Coast faces freezing temperatures this week, many cities have issued weather emergency alerts that allow them to place people who are homeless into emergency shelters. Well, today we talk about a new investigation by The Guardian that looks at how cities struggle to solve the problem of homelessness throughout the year and found many have come to rely on an old solution, a one-way ticket out of town. Relocation programs that offer homeless people free bus tickets to move elsewhere have been around for at least three decades. But as the homeless population rises for the first time since the Great Recession, relocation programs are becoming more common and are expanding to more cities.
In its investigation, The Guardian closely examined these homeless relocation programs by compiling and analyzing a database of more than 34,000 bus trips or flights taken by homeless people out of their cities. They found the journey provided a route out of homelessness for some, but many eventually returned to the city they'd left. This is 27-year-old Quinn Raber, who traveled nearly 2,300 miles over 3 days from San Francisco to Indianapolis by bus, only to return.
I wasn't expecting to come back to San Francisco as soon as I did, but I knew I was going to end up coming back eventually. The roughest part about being homeless is the wear and tear from the concrete and the constant walking and It's hard to use the restroom because a lot of businesses don't want homeless people in their restrooms and messing them up. You know, it really breaks you down. I don't know if I would ask Homeward Bound for a ticket again, just because I know that you're not really supposed to ask for more than one. But if they, you know, if they would be willing to help, I'd ask them, you know.
For more, we're joined in San Francisco by Alistair G., the homelessness editor for The Guardian. The new investigation by The Outside and America team headlined Bust Out, How America Moves Its Homeless. Alistair, welcome to Democracy Now! Just lay out what you found.
Thank you so much for having me. Well, we made dozens of public records requests, and our goal was to really understand what effect these bus programs were having on the homeless population in America. Cities, of course, would say that these programs are a really great way to offer people more stability. It's a way to reconnect people with family or with friends in other locations and perhaps offer them a route out of homelessness. And we found that while in some cases that was certainly what happened, for some people it certainly was a way to greater stability. For others, it wasn't quite that simple. We found cases where people simply became homeless at their destination. In some instances, they even became homeless again in the city from which they had departed. So the story really isn't quite as simple, and it really isn't quite as rosy a picture as cities would portray.
According to a new federal study, the U.S. homeless population, as we said earlier, rose this year for the first time since the Great Recession. What do you know about why that is and what the impact of that has been?
Right. That's a really good point. Well, the rise has been driven in particular by the trends that we're seeing on the West Coast, and that's to do with a rental affordability crisis. Everywhere from Seattle down to Los Angeles and San Diego, it's simply becoming impossible for people earning certainly minimum wage, but even wages above that. It's very, very difficult to afford somewhere to live. So that's what's really driving the trend. And I think that the picture that is in the background here and that's been a constant element of the homelessness crisis in the U.S. is a long-term federal underinvestment in affordable housing, something that was really begun, these cuts in the Reagan era, and in the opinion of advocates, has never really been properly been redressed since then.
This is 62-year-old Willie Romines, who took a bus from Key West to Ocala, Florida. He told The Guardian because he accepted a free bus ticket from the shelter he was living in, he was barred from returning.
It's like, close the door, get out of here, we bought you a bus ticket, you can't come back. That put a hurting on me. I feel like I was swindled. Since I've been banned from the shelter, I've stayed on Smathers Beach, behind buildings, behind bushes, hedgerows. I've slept next to dumpsters and stuff like that. They tell you anything because they want you out of here. They want all the homeless out of Key West.
And this is Rose Thompson, a 58-year-old woman who relocated from Florida to West Virginia. She told The Guardian she went back to Key West only 3 weeks after leaving.
I had a seizure and my heart stopped at the soup kitchen. So I wanted to go back to West Virginia and stay with my daughter. They were staying, and it's like in a three-bedroom trailer. And then her little boy slept on the couch where I was sleeping, so they wanted me to go to a homeless shelter. And, well, I didn't want to stay in a homeless shelter in West Virginia because I don't know anybody up there anymore. And from the time I left here to the time I got back, it was exactly 3 weeks.
So if you can talk about these people, Alistair G., and talk about, you know, what their circumstances were, and also how much are taxpayers paying for all of that simply for them to return?
Well, Willie was a person that one of our reporters met in Key West. And as you mentioned earlier, the Key West scheme is really unusual in that of the 15 or so programs from which we received data, Key West was the only one that had this stipulation. They essentially made you sign a kind of contract If you went to the program and requested a bus ticket, they would ask you to essentially declare that should you return to Key West, that you wouldn't avail yourself of homeless services there on the island again. And so what this means is that you have people like Rose, for instance, who are sleeping on beaches, sleeping outdoors, because essentially they have taken a ticket. It didn't work out where they came from, and they've just ended up back in Key West. So in the case of Rose, for instance, she wanted to travel back to West Virginia, where she's from, to stay with her daughter. She got back there. It turns out that her daughter simply wasn't able to offer her the kind of support that she needed to find her way out of homelessness. Rose would be living in an overcrowded trailer. She was sleeping on a couch. And eventually her daughter had to take her to a homeless shelter in West Virginia. So Rose ended up coming back to Key West, and that's where she is now. And so she simply has no shelter. She has nowhere to stay. And so she, unfortunately, is sleeping outdoors there.
Well,
I think you were also...
Please go ahead.
Could you remind me of your other question?
Talking about, you know, the cost to taxpayers, since what we're talking about now is people who take these journeys, whether bus or plane, some feeling coerced, and then they end up back in the city they're in.
Right. Well, we have figures from the city of New York, for instance, which budgets $500,000 per year for its program. And cities around the country, while not quite, they don't have programs that are quite as large as the one in New York, I think we can safely assume that over the course of years, that cities are spending millions of dollars on these kinds of things. And it's interesting because the efficacy of these programs, while cities would say that these are a good way to help people get out of homelessness, there really isn't very much long-term research that testifies to that. So, for instance, we spoke to the city of San Francisco and requested data from them, and they provided many, many years' data going back to the 2000s. But, for instance, for a five-year period between 2010 and 2015, when the city offered thousands of people bus tickets and thousands of people left the city could only provide us records showing that it had been able to follow up with only three of those people to find out if their situation at the other end had improved. And that was really, that was a similar situation across the board. While a few smaller cities did have some long-term follow-up data, mostly they did not. And the cities really had no idea what happened to the people who had taken tickets out of their cities.
And Alistair, what did you find about the percentage of people who opt to leave the cities they're living in, the homeless people who opt to leave, and those who are in some sense coerced or forced to leave?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think it's important to mention from the outset that the majority of people who are homeless in any given city are from that city. Whenever cities do their homeless population counts, they often do surveys, and they find this trend that's replicated across the board. And so it is actually a myth that, as is common in many cities in the West, that somebody is drawn there for the services or for the weather. Most people are actually from that city. But for the percentage, the small percentage that aren't from that city, these programs can be a good choice. In terms of coercion, it wasn't something that we found very often. These programs generally are voluntary, and the way it works is that someone would take themselves to a ticket office and they would make a request for a ticket, and that's how it would work. But in the case of one family in New York, the Ortiz family, we did find that they felt that they had been given no other choice than to take a ticket. Jose Ortiz, he told us that he had gone to the city's homelessness department in the summer this year. His young family had been homeless in the city of New York, and he had requested some help, just some time, really, to help him get his family back on his feet. He says that the city determined that because he had, in their words, a better housing option on the island of Puerto Rico, that he wasn't eligible for homeless services in the city of New York. And in his terms, as it was laid out to him, he was given only one choice, which was to take the plane ticket out of town.
Can you talk about what's happening in San Francisco right now, which is experiencing a homeless crisis, looking at the impact that the number of the people bussed out of the city have, and also right here in New York City, if you can talk about one of the first places to adopt the so-called relocation program?
Yeah, so to deal with the second point first, New York, as far as we could tell, was the first major city to launch a program. Its program came about in around 1987, and it hasn't continued without pause since then. It was relaunched in its current form under Mayor Bloomberg, but it certainly has a lot of history there. The program in San Francisco came about later, in around 2005, and the officials in San Francisco told me that, in fact, a police commander told me that they were looking to the example of the city of Sacramento, and they thought, why can't we have a program like that? And so the effect, as you mentioned, on San Francisco's homeless population has been quite dramatic. We looked at the homeless counts in San Francisco over many years, and we tried to calculate what the population of the city, the homeless population, would have been had this program not existed. And we did a very rough back-of-the-envelope calculation. And over the years, around 10,500 people have received bus tickets from San Francisco's Homeward Bound program. And its homeless population today on any one night is around 7,000 to 8,000 people. And so, of course, our calculation doesn't take into account people who might have come into San Francisco through other bus programs for which we don't have data, or people who have become homeless in San Francisco while living in San Francisco. But very roughly, we estimated that the population of San Francisco could have been 18,000 homeless people on any one night had this program not existed. So that's more than double the current population of around 7,000 to 8,000.
Well, let's go to Key West, Florida. You spoke also to a former shelter official there in Key West who defended the policy of banning people who've been relocated from returning. This is Mike Tolbert.
The reason it's a one-way ticket, we don't want a revolving door travel agency. You let them come back, they're going to want another ticket. And then you get the people, everybody wanting a ticket, everybody wanting to come back, and it's just not going to work. The program will not work. The folks that take the bus ticket and complain about it, they think we owe them something. We gave you all we can give you. There is nothing else we can give you. I'm good with it.
So that's Mike Tolbert in Key West, Florida. Alistair, can you say how representative his example is of other homeless people in Florida and even elsewhere?
Well, the Key West program, there was certainly the most, I would say, forthright about that kind of thing. As I mentioned, the Key West program did seem in some senses to be an outlier, I would say, because other programs emphasized more that this was more of a humanitarian effort to assist people, and Key West came down quite squarely. I suppose they would say that it was both a humanitarian thing, but also they were doing a good thing by reducing the population and by giving these people one-way tickets out of town. And so I wouldn't say that attitude is extremely representative, but it is very, very unusual. And that's why we sent some reporters there to meet people like Willie and Rose and to hear more about their stories.
And the story of the person who was flown from New York to Puerto Rico. Explain that program, and particularly now, after Hurricane Maria.
Right. Well, the Ortiz family, as I mentioned, they took a plane ticket back in August. And as they felt, it was under duress. They really didn't want to go. It was a man, his wife, their two young children. And our reporter noticed that the parents were doing their best to put a brave face on it when they were at JFK. The kids were very, very happy to be going on a plane. But the parents, they were really trying to mask their feelings about it. And so they traveled back to Puerto Rico in August. We were able to stay in touch with them a little bit over Facebook. When Jose Ortiz returned to Puerto Rico, he messaged us to say that he had a job interview as a security guard, and so he was feeling optimistic about that. But once the hurricane had been through, it became hard for us to get in touch with him. And we really, despite our efforts, haven't been able to get back in touch with them since then. And so we don't know now how that family is doing, unfortunately.
Finally, taxes. That's the big news of the Christmas and holiday weekends, as President Trump has just signed this and said that this helps poor and working people. What are your concerns about taxes and homelessness?
Well, all the advocates that I spoke to were hoping, maybe vainly, I think they would say, that tax reform might be a boon for affordable housing, for the construction of homes that really the most impoverished Americans could afford. And there was particular focus on the mortgage interest deduction, which is this tax break that you can take. Essentially, it goes to the wealthiest Americans who use it to help them buy more expensive homes. That's the verdict of tax analysts, even though it's intended as a kind of middle class tax break. And so experts were hoping that this would be reformed and that the revenues from that would be channeled into affordable housing construction. As it stands, the government spends twice as much on that tax break for the wealthiest Americans than it does on rental assistance, the Section 8 program for the poorest Americans. And so in the reconciled version of the tax bill, as it appears now, there has been a little bit of reform of that deduction, but it doesn't seem that that money, at least it hasn't been stated outright, that that money is going to be channeled into affordable housing production, which is what advocates would really like. So I think there's a broad sense of disappointment that this was an opportunity here to really potentially transform the landscape, and that doesn't seem to be the case at all.
And the freezing weather?
The freezing weather is extreme elements are really the bane of a homeless person's life. We reported back in the summer the burning temperatures in Arizona during that heat wave. It was extremely difficult for homeless people who couldn't even walk on the asphalt because it was burning. And it's the same with the cold weather today. Unfortunately, it's very, very hard to make it on the streets if you're trying to simply stay alive because of the elements. I'm sure in Washington, D.C., as is always the case, and as has been the case for decades now, we'll see people trying to warm themselves on grates, because that is, for many people, simply the only source of heat that there is. And so I know that advocates across the West in particular are just looking out for that and watching for snowfall and trying to help people as best they can.
Absolutely astounding weather from International Falls, Minnesota, 37 degrees below zero, Erie, Pennsylvania, over 5 feet of snow has fallen there, and they expect more. Alistair G., thanks so much for being with us, homelessness editor for The Guardian. His team's latest article, based on an 18-month investigation, is headlined Bust Out, How America Moves Its Homeless. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. When we come back, we'll be speaking with a journalist about her own memoir. It's called Mental, Lithium, Love, and Losing My Mind. Stay with us.
So sick and tired of this world. All these women with their dreams shattered. From some man's sweaty, desperate touch. God damn it.
By First Aid Kit. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Everyone has a brain, which plays a major role in mental illness. I think everyone is, temporarily or not, a little mentally ill. That's what our next guest is told by a leading psychiatrist whom she meets in Rome in a quest that takes her from a psychiatric ward in Los Angeles to Italy and Bolivia as she tries to come to grips with the effects of lithium, the drug she's prescribed when she's diagnosed at the age of 16 with bipolar disorder. According to the American Psychiatric Association, bipolar disorders are, quote, brain disorders that cause changes in a person's mood, energy, energy and ability to function. Bipolar disorder used to be called manic depression.
Well, every year, some 44 million Americans experience mental illness, of which almost 6 million are diagnosed as bipolar. In her remarkable memoir titled Mental, Lithium, Love, and Losing My Mind, Jamie Lowe shares and investigates her experience with mental illness and the drugs used to combat it. She was on lithium for 2 decades, but was forced to go off it when she experienced serious kidney problems as a result of the medication. She points to statistics published by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that show the use of prescription medication for antidepressants among all ages increased nearly 400% over the last 2 decades. To talk more about her experience with an illness that's still associated with social stigma, despite affecting tens of millions of Americans, we're joined now by author and journalist Jamie Lowe. Welcome to Democracy Now!,
Jamie. Thank you so much for having me.
This is a profound book. Why don't you start off where you first learned, where you first were diagnosed, and talk about your experience at the age of 16 in a Los Angeles psych ward.
Well, it started a little bit before that because I was cycling, and so I was pretty
much... But what does that mean, cycling?
Explain. So I was on a manic high, which meant that I was hallucinating. I thought I could talk to Michael Jackson. I thought I knew secret tunnels to Neverland. I was, like, imagining Muppets, and some of it was very... You know, some parts of mental illness are kind of funny. Many parts are horrible, and, you know, I had accused my dad of being physically abusive. He had never been physically abusive. And at this point, you know, I was running away from him. And all of my parents are divorced. So I have like a million parents. But they all had sort of seen this pattern of disarray, mental disarray, I guess. They had figured out that the adolescent ward at UCLA was the best place for treatment and had sort of taken me to the ER. And so that's where I ended up. But I had to take a lot of antipsychotics. I had to go through a lot before Dr. D'Antonio, who was the head of adolescent care there, diagnosed me. He identified it immediately because the symptoms are so bizarre but all similar.
And how long did you stay in that psychiatric ward?
I was there for about 3 weeks. So the first 3 weeks of my senior year.
And what was your experience there?
It was terrible. And it was also, you know, fantastic because I got better. So the beginning of it, I was very resistant to medications. I was, you know, still hallucinating. I was still delusional. I thought an apocalypse was happening. I thought I was going to be going to war in Nicaragua. There were these enormous pipes outside the window, and it was just the generator of the hospital. But I had this idea that they were poison gas and that it was going to be like another Holocaust and we were all going to die. And that was the bad part. The good part was when I kind of came to the realization that I needed to take the medication.
And the medication was lithium?
Yes.
What did it mean to you that your illness was named? And what did they tell you at the time that you were suffering from?
So that's a really good question. They told me I was manic depressive, which was what it was called when I was diagnosed in 93. It's now called bipolar disorder. To me, it doesn't make a difference. I am what I am, like Popeye. But the label is just a category, and it helps to sort of identify with other people, to know that you're not alone in experiencing everything that's going on, because the symptoms and what's happening is so bizarre. I mean, there are so many things that are just beyond imaginable. And so it's nice to know that those things exist in other people's worlds as well. I mean, like, one thing is extreme religiosity. I'm not a religious person at all. But when I was in the hospital, I was like saying, you know, the prayers I had, the rabbis were visiting me. I was like, you know, really, really into being Jewish and Judaism and like super duper like celebrating Shabbat. My family is completely not they're very reform and were not on that trip. But in the hospital, I was extremely religious. So that's something that many people who are bipolar experience. You know, that was one of the few things in the book where I was trying to really find a reason for that, because the symptoms are so bizarre. But that one was sort of like, nope, they just are the symptoms that they are.
Well, while you were in the psychiatric ward, you were kept for a period of time in isolation.
Yeah.
And despite what people may think of that, which is that it's very scary or claustrophobic, it actually helped you. Explain why.
I think that that was my breaking point. I think that, you know, in the same way that, and this sounds horrible, but the same way that you break a horse, like, I think that I was just so far gone, and I had been tackled by nurses to take medication at that point. I had been, like, whispering all of these, you know, conspiracy theories to different patients. I was, like, a menace to everyone on the ward, and they kind of just put me in this box, and I think, even though it sounds terrible, I just let go of everything and kind of collapsed and realized that I needed to kind of reevaluate. And that was a glimpse of that. I don't think that I was like completely better, and it was an aha moment. I was like, okay, great. But I felt calmer. Like I have a distinct memory of like a, like just a little taste of calm.
Can you, because you're a journalist and you've really deeply researched all of this now, and you're so deeply informed by your own personal experience, talk about what the definition of bipolar disorder is, and then also describe how you changed on lithium, what kind of effects it had on you and in your research and interviews with so many other people who have experienced this, what it meant to them?
Sure. The definition, as I understand it, for bipolar disorder would be that there is a period of manic highs followed by a cycle of depression, and it can either be long depression with one long mania, or it can be like mania, depression. The thing about mental illness is that it's so individual, and everybody sort of has their own. You know, as the symptoms are very similar, but each person really, it's the hardest thing to treat because it's just your own experience is slightly different from the person next to you, which is why it's really hard to tackle as a national issue. In terms of
medication.
Yes, medication.
And explain what lithium is. And explain how what effect it had on you and why you eventually, after decades, had to give it up.
So lithium's the third element on the periodic table. So it is present in the Big Bang. It's this kind of amazing miracle salt. It also is a metal. It's present everywhere on Earth, in the galaxy, in our bodies, for everyone. So the lithium for me, when I took it, I didn't actually feel that many side effects. A lot of people feel side effects. A lot of people it doesn't work for. For me, it was kind of seamless. And I think part of the reason it was seamless was because it had to be. I had been experiencing just so much tumult in my life that to have something that kind of evened everything out was good. And I was in my senior year and I kind of just let go of everything else and was like, okay, this is what's going to work for me and this is what I have to do and this is what's going forward I'm going to have to take. That year was really hard just because I was kind of, you know, gave up on high school and friends and everything. But then when I went to college, everything was great, and I didn't really think about it. Lithium was kind of in my back pocket and worked. And then it worked so well, actually, that I, with my psychiatrist, once I had moved to New York after college, we decided that I could, taper down, try life without lithium.
Because after how long?
I was 25, so it was about
9 years after you'd started it.
So that was not a good idea. Although, I mean, who was to know, you know, because it could have been an isolated incident.
I mean, so many people describe wanting to experience the highs and lows of life, which is why they go off of it.
Right.
So what did it mean to, quote, taper down in your life?
So I still experience the highs and lows in life in a pretty hyperbolic form, even with lithium. I still get really anxious when, there's too much work on my plate. I still am really, really, like, excited about random things that I can't identify. But when happiness comes, it comes, and it's great. But when I'm not on the medication, the highs and lows are unmanageable. They're, like, highs that are wearing, you know, head-to-toe glitter and, like, 18 tutus, 16 belts, 30 necklaces, and, like, you know, this, like, crazy... And I can see it, like, when I'm on the subway, sometimes I'll see someone and I'm like, oh, I recognize that outfit. Like, that looks a lot like something that I would have loved when I was not on my meds.
Well, one of the things that you point out, I mean, a part of the reason that this memoir is so remarkable is that, you know, there's still a lot of stigma attached to mental illness. So it took a lot of courage for you to write as you did. And similarly, it's often very difficult for people to accept that they need medication for mental illness. Mm-hmm. You didn't have those problems.
That's true. I can see the stigma and I understand it and I see it with other people. For me, I come from, like, I think I just have never really had a filter. I haven't, the courage part didn't really even occur to me because I've always talked a lot about being bipolar. And maybe that's because I was diagnosed when I was 16 and it's always been kind of a part of who I am. And describing it is not something that I feel bad about myself for. There are moments, though, when I'm like, please, I don't want to think about medication anymore. Like, I don't want to do this the rest of my life. I don't want to have to. And I think that that is, like, a totally natural reaction that everyone who suffers from mental illness sort of has to deal with.
I don't think you described that point where you tapered off and what it meant in terms of what happened to you.
Yeah.
And then when you ultimately had to go off it, which is more recent, because of kidney trouble.
Right. So the tapering off was in 2001. It was in January of 2001. And actually, it was earlier than that. And the manic episode that followed was that winter. And that was like, I just started acting really weird. And I was actually living only a few blocks from your studio, which was really funny because I just walked by my old apartment. And I would quit my job. I was freelancing. I had a job offer. I was like, I don't want to work anymore. I'm going to barter for things. I'm going to just like buy Brussels sprouts and like squash. And like I was sending like $700 of squash to neighbors. And one of the things that triggered the really, really bad parts of that episode is that when I was on one of the job interviews that I went on for, I think it was Blender magazine, which was this music magazine published by Maxim and stuff, and my apartment burned down. And it was, like, horrifying and just, like, this thing that made everything a billion times worse. And it just triggered this really, really intense, it was probably a good 6 months where I was back and forth between New York and LA because I wouldn't stay in LA where my parents were trying to like help me get better. They didn't want to put me into an adult psychiatric care because it was like the circumstances of that are just way beyond getting better even. So I then ended up in L.A. for 3 months with my family and then came back here and was, like, pretty depressed for 6 months. It was really, really hard.
And were you self-aware? I mean, since you were working with a doctor, you knew you were tapering down. Did you understand you were in a full manic phase, that this was the effect?
No. So, I mean, No, I didn't want to know that I was in a manic phase. I was basically like, I'm fine. This is amazing. Everything that's happening is the way it should be. And you guys are all crazy.
We're going to break and then come back to this discussion with Jamie Lowe. She's an author and journalist. Her latest book is just out. It's titled Mental, Lithium, Love, and Losing My Mind. When we come back, we'll go from that UCLA adolescent psych ward to the salt flats of Bolivia, where so much of lithium is. Stay with us.
I've been nobody's child. I've been nobody's child. So when my blood started running wild, oh, when my blood started running wild, I've been a hungry ghost. I've been a hungry ghost. And I traveled from coast to coast. Oh, I traveled from coast to coast. When will you help me out? You can't even pick me out of the crowd. Oh, and I don't need you anymore. So then why am I standing at your door?
Hungry Ghost by Linda Segarra of Hooray for the Riff Raff, performing here in our Democracy Now! Studio. To see her full performances and interview, go to democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Our guest is Jamie Lowe, author of Mental, Lithium, Love, and Losing My Mind. It's a memoir. Nermeen?
Before we go to your trip to Bolivia, which is where most half of the world's lithium is found, I wanted to talk about the fact that in your book you raise the question of the two different traumas that you experienced that what you say triggered your bipolar disorder. Now, there's a lot of debate within the psychiatric community about to what extent this disorder, which used to be known as manic depression, is caused by a chemical imbalance and what's caused by environmental factors. So can you say what role you think trauma plays in this?
It's a really good question because it is controversial and totally unknowable in some ways. I think that it's a factor of both environment and genetics. I think that my family definitely has a history of mental illness. My grandfather on my mom's side comes from a family that has some mental illness in it, and he was sort of late. He was as an elder person, he sort of had a bout of depression that was pretty serious. But I was molested when I was 13, and I think that a lot of, you know, there was this comprehensive study of research from the past 40 years that basically said that that sexual assault victims are associated with mental illness. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean it triggers it or that it causes it, but that there is this link between the two things. And I think that there's almost, you know, when I think about my episodes, they sometimes revolve around those types of, like, that trauma is involved in some of my hallucinations. They were involved in some of the things that were kind of the outlandish part of the way I was behaving were manifestations of having been assaulted.
In what sense, though? In what sense would you say that's the case?
I think that, you know, identifying male figures in my life, like my dad, and saying that he had abused me and that that abuse actually was coming from somewhere else. Like, he has never abused me. He's been a loving father my entire life and very supportive and trying to understand what all of this is, as all my parents have always tried to do. Because it's not easy. I think, like, when somebody loses their mind and loses who they are and can't function the way that you know them to function on a daily basis, it's really hard to understand that that's not who they are. And I think that I think the sexual assault actually is part of it. And I think that then each episode is also a trauma in itself, because they're really, really intense, really, really kind of, they sort of shift the way your life moves, and it's like a different narrative then, you know, as if there was a parallel one, what would have happened? Like, I have no idea. Like, this is who I am. This is the way that my life played out. But I think, like, each time something happens, there's like a little bit a part of you kind of shifts with it.
Can you talk about what happened after 20 years when your kidneys were affected and you had to completely go off of lithium, your fears at the time?
Yeah.
And what you went on to?
So that was what basically brought on this book, is that I had realized that I had this almost love affair with lithium, like this relationship with lithium that it really helped me function for 2 decades in a way that I never would have had. And that the minute that I had this physical like reminder that it wasn't actually 100% good for me, or that it was, you know, eating away at my kidneys, which is not a technical term, that I had to know more about it. Like, I didn't know more about it. I didn't know anything about it as a medication. I didn't really know much about it in its place in the world. And the minute I started investigating it, it was like this miracle drug. Nobody really still knows how it works. And it's been used for millennia. How it felt for me personally was like nothing but distraught and just like complete fear that I would end up manic again because another medication wouldn't work.
And so what did they give you?
So I the first time I tried Depakote, it was just the side effects were really, really intense. And I like was crying all the time and it was a mess. And this was like the thing I had not experienced with lithium when I was first prescribed it. A lot of people don't react well to medications. It's why mental illness is really hard to treat also. It's why it's hard to get mentally ill people to stay on medications, as the side effects can be really severe. So I was on Depakote. It was really, really hard. I got off of it because I just couldn't deal with it. And I ended up taking another medication, Tegretol, which then it turned out was toxic for my liver, which was a sort of random thing that my general practitioner found at a routine physical. Thank goodness, or not, whatever. I was sort of out of the really good medications for mania. The rest of the medications are more for depression, and I suffer more from mania. So my psychiatrist and I decided that I would try Depakote again. And I tried it, and it was actually, like, way better. It worked out way better. I was feeling fine. It was okay. And all of the side effects I had felt initially were like there, but way less. So I just sort of assumed they were psychosomatic.
Before we go, we wanted to talk about Bolivia just for a moment. We only have 2 minutes. So can you talk about the journey you took to the place, the land of lithium,
where
half of lithium is found?
Yes. The journey, I mean, it's like, it's a magical place for me. Like I think for anyone who's there, because it has this kind of moonscape. It feels like you're in a completely different universe where everything is kind of this crystalline green, and you can kind of feel the salt crawling up your body and sort of immersing itself in your pores. And it was like I wanted to just roll around in it and kind of pay homage to this thing that had helped me for so long. They have these little salt hotels you can stay in the middle of the Salar, and they're not really hotels. They're like a cot where you stay near springs that you can soak in, and the water is like really laden with lithium, and you can just sit there with like this steam rising up, and it's a really kind of magical place, I guess. For
well, one of the things that you say in terms of the extent to which lithium is prescribed is that it's not a patented drug.
Right.
So what does that mean in terms of people's access to lithium?
So it's really cheap. People aren't, like, psychiatrists don't prescribe it as much because it's not as marketed by pharmaceutical companies. Hmm. But lithium is, the problem is that there aren't more tests done on lithium for other applications because there isn't a market for it. Like, there's no money to be made. Right. So there are studies that have said that it's good for Parkinson's, it's good for ALS, that it's good in a lot of different ways for brain function besides just treating bipolar disorder.
We have 20 seconds.
Okay.
With the millions of people expected to fall off healthcare, are you concerned about the mentally ill in this country?
I'm always concerned about the mentally ill in this country because the healthcare doesn't even cover enough mental illness coverage. Like, it's just, there are, you know, 30% of people in homeless shelters are mentally ill, 24% of people in state prisons are mentally ill. You know, there are a lot of people to be concerned about.
We want to thank you for being with us, Jamie, and
thank
for writing
so
this
much.
Book, Mental, Lithium, Love, and Losing My Mind. That does it for today's show. If you'd like to get a copy, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Accepting applications for a paid year-long news fellowship. Details at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Democracy Now! Is our news hour.